Good morning. Childcare and preschool are big hurdles for even middle-class families. Two studies out this week show just how much. Hawaii Children Action Network Deborah Zeisman joins us this morning with a look at gaps in state child care assistance. And the Hawaii Farm Bureau wrapped up its convention this week with a list of action items. Bureau Executive Director Brian Miyamoto gives us a look at what farmers are facing that could impact what you buy. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Sydney Saito is a marionette puppet master who knows how our ancient art can fire children's imaginations and how the Kauai Endangered Seabirds Recovery Project works with the community to save endangered native species.
It's a Friday, October 28th. That's the conversation that starts right after this news. Good morning. It's a Friday all across the islands, as Derek Malama likes to say for
and
the
all
time
day.
Check. And all day, too. And thanks very much for joining us. And good to have with us our HPR2 listeners now in East Hawaii.
Very much so, yeah. Well, you're going to take a look at the future of Hawaii farming. A lot of interest in that, yeah.
Interest for all of us in terms of what we can find at our grocery stores and certainly what the governor has had to say about locally produced goods. Well, land, water, labor, you know that for a Hawaii farmer, that triad in balance can mean a successful business, but it's out of whack. It could threaten the farmer's existence. And it could certainly threaten what local produce shows up in grocery stores, even with the governor's pledge to double food production by 2030. Add in the new Food Safety Modernization Act, testing requirements and cost, and how Hawaii farmers, particularly small farmers, can comply to bring produce from their farms to your meal, well, it gets a little less clear. These were some of the issues the Hawaii Farm Bureau members had on their agenda during their 2016 convention this week. Executive Director Brian Miyamoto joins us now by phone with some of the key action items. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thank you for having me on your program this morning.
Everyone is concerned with how we're going to increase food production. That's a long-standing conversation, certainly one that you've been part of and that the Bureau has been part of. As you look at it where we are today, doesn't this really mean that agriculture is going to have to get a lot more money put into it?
Absolutely. We always talk about investment in agriculture, and we see a lot of support. We see, as you referenced, the governor's goal of increasing food production, doubling food production. Our state legislature has been extremely supportive and putting funding and also policies to assisting our farmers and ranchers, because we do need support in order to grow our industry. We don't want to sustain agriculture. We want to grow agriculture. We want to produce more of the food, fiber, the feed, and the flora. We want to maintain that rural ambience. So we need support from everyone, not just the legislature administration, but from the general public at hand.
But when it comes to money, you're looking squarely at government to be able to help with that. Up to this point where you say they've been very supportive, but to grow agriculture in the way that you and your members have been talking about it this week, what would have to happen?
Well, several different areas. You know, the Department of Agriculture right now, they get 0.4 of the state budget. We're looking for, more resources for the Department of Agriculture. One of the big issues, and you covered some of the major ones, land, water, labor, but invasive species is a big issue. We need more inspectors out there. We need to protect not just the agriculture industry, but the environment. So we're looking for more resources as far as for biosecurity. That was one of the big topics. Invasive species is a huge topic. We've got anywhere from, the Koki frog, little fire ants. Our Kauai delegation brought up the rose ring parakeet that's just damaging their crops. They love the fruit crops there. So the farmers are struggling with the rose ring parakeet. Our cull industry, not just on Kauai, but especially on Kauai in Hālalei Valley. You've got the moorhen and the coot. And these aren't invasive. These are endangered species. But again, crop degradation, we need to prevent you know, invasive species, and we need to support our farmers. You've got, you know, our iconic Kona coffee, our coffee industry, and macadamia nut industry under attack from the Mac Felton Coxid and coffee berry borer. So, you know, to put up the line of defense with invasive species, to put up more biosecurity facilities and inspectors so that we can prevent them from coming in versus trying to be reactionary, be more proactive instead of reactive when they're here, and sometimes when they're, you know, ingrained so much, like on the Big Island with the cookie.
I mean, that's a directly allied issue to being able to produce more, but that's also going to be putting money into something that clearly isn't going to be going into, you know, crop development and being able to augment agriculture in the way that you'd like to see it happen. But you're looking at this, you know, in stages. We often talk about the age of farmers being, you know, north of 50, and many people say north of 60. But there's also an issue with labor.
Absolutely. So, you know, two parts of labor, and you know, I believe the average age here in Hawaii is of the farmer is 60. So replacing the next generation of farmers, again, and the legislature has been supportive with Department of Labor heading a council with Department of Education, Department of Agriculture, and other stakeholders sitting on that, and funding so that we can address ag education. You know, we need to produce the next generation of farmers, but currently we also need agricultural labor. Farming is hard. So, you know, when unemployment is low, our farmers do struggle. We struggle with paying competitive rates. You're out in the hot sun. So we actually formed a ad hoc labor committee to address this issue, to see if there are solutions out there to not only address the current situation of not having enough farm labor for our farmers and ranchers now, but also ag education. And we had Hawaii Ag Foundation out there doing great work, trying to educate our youth, because not only will be they'll be the next generation of farmers, they'll also be the next generation of consumers and policymakers. So we want to reconnect or connect our youth. I grew up here with pineapple and sugar, and we're surrounded, and there was a connection with agriculture. Not so much anymore. We don't see it as much out there. So we want to connect our youth, our children with agriculture, so that we can continue to support our industry.
Add into this whole mix, there's still the FDA rule, the Food Safety Modernization Act, and all the rules that the FDA have now created with all of this. But there are some exemptions for food that is not consumed raw, for produce that you traditionally, you know, you wouldn't consume coffee beans raw, or you wouldn't consume pumpkin or legumes. Does that mean that we're going to see potentially more of that, because that might be easier for farmers to do without so much constraint around it?
You know, there's still so much uncertainty on the Food Safety Modernization Act. You know, we hope we see more of everything. But I've heard that the phrase game changer, FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, could be a game changer. It's a regulation. It's a law that our farmers, produce farmers, need to comply with. And we're seeing that there's some challenges with our small farmers. So, again, the Farm Bureau has been, you know, working with the Department of Agriculture, the College of Tropical Agriculture, and legislative support in trying to find solutions to help our farmers with compliance. You brought up exemptions, and, you know, although there are some exemptions based on your size, time that you can, 4 years until you need to comply, that may not matter if our buyers are requiring some type of food safety certification, be it the federal law or a private third-party audit. So what we're trying to do is, instead of saying, well, we think we have exemptions, we're saying we're going to work with our farmers. We're going to assist them to be compliant. The legislature had funded the Department of Agriculture for positions for food safety. Department of Ag is funding CTAR. The legislature has given the Hawaii Farm Bureau granting aid with the specific intent of assisting our farmers with the compliance, because I've heard the number 30% of the farmers may not be able to comply. So if they don't have a market to sell to, they're not going to be farming anymore, and we're not going to be able to achieve this doubling of our food production if we've got less farmers.
Brian, which is, you know, why I was asking you, would you see that perhaps that farmers might do a shift in what they're willing to produce, and obviously what all of us would be willing to buy, if those exemptions could be, you know, can be used to grow more coffee, grow more legumes, grow, you know, more squash, and sort of, you know, switch our eating habits a little bit, because they don't have to have some of the same testing requirements for those goods.
Possibly we could. You know, I don't want to speak for the farmer, but again, if your operation is designed around a certain crop, it may not be that easy to switch to a different crop. As far as your equipment and, you know, your labor and how you grow that crop, so it may not be that simple. Some farmers will. They'll evolve because they want to continue to farm, but again, there's so much uncertainty. So, you know, we want to see them continue to produce the products that they're producing, the foods that they're producing, the produce that they're producing. So that is a possibility, Bethann, but we'd like to, you know, instead of going that route, we want to try to continue to allow them to continue to do what they're doing and all of us supporting that and, again, not just continue, but to grow their operation and to grow more and more diverse crops.
As you're talking about diversity, that also backs into a conversation about water and water usage and how much more or potentially less a farmer might need to be able to produce, you know, produce that we'll all purchase.
Yes, water is always a big issue. You know, and it's a topic that comes up at our annual meeting. It is a convention, but it's an annual business meeting where, you know, members from across the state along with stakeholders and leaders can get together and discuss issues that affect all farmers and ranchers. You know, one of the legislative items that came out was addressing water infrastructure. You know, they were built and maintained by the plantations, and now, you know, they are older and falling apart. So the legislature, every year we go back and we identify systems that need maintenance or need to be built, drought mitigation. We like to build more reservoirs to capture water when there's times of plenty. You know, because without water, there's absolutely no farming.
So
we also had the revocable permit issue that came up last year. And some of our smaller farmers who hold these revocable permits, you know, they've been informed by the Department of Land and Natural Resources that they need to do, you know, there's certain requirements in order to get the permit, EISs or EAs. And, again, some of our farmers are unable to comply or unable to afford these things. So we're looking at solutions and trying to work with our administration, trying to work with stakeholders. Because, again, we don't want all these regulations coming up and all these challenges because farmers have razor thin margins to begin with. It's hard work, and the more roadblocks that are put in front of them, the harder it is for them to continue farming. Again, we're not going to address doubling our food production. We're not going to address, you know, our vibrant export nursery industry and floriculture industry, you know, and our coffee industry. All these crops and agricultural products that people can identify with Hawaii, you know, could be in jeopardy. So we're constantly looking for support from everyone.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We have to move on now. But thank you, Brian, for joining us today.
Again, thank you, Bethann, for having us on this morning. Appreciate it.
Brian Miyamoto is the Executive Director of the Hawaii Farm Bureau. The organization had its annual business meeting and convention this week.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Noheya Gallery, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio at 8:17. Coming up in the show, the ancient art of puppetry brought to life. But first, your quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we're taking a look at a Hawaiian legend that spawned a tradition still observed to this day. The island of Molokai is the fifth largest Hawaiian island and one of the least populated, with fewer than 8,000 residents. Around 40% of those residents have Hawaiian ancestry, and the island's traditions reflect that heritage. The Friendly Isle is held to be the origin of hula, the ancient Hawaiian dance form. Free Western oral history tells of a woman named La'ila'i who lived in the Ka'ana district of Mauna Loa. She practiced a sacred dance which was passed down to her ancestors after her death in the 9th century and only performed there. Five generations later, a woman named Laka was born in the La'ila'i clan. Against her family's wishes, she left Molokai with a mission to share the art form across all of Hawaii. The tradition of dance spread across the islands with this rebellious girl, and she was later deified as Laka, the Hawaiian goddess of hula. Although the legend is hundreds of years old, legacy is still celebrated today in an annual hula festival that takes place on Molokai. For this morning's quiz, can you tell us the festival's name? Be the first to get it right, and an HPR t-shirt is yours. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689.
I'm Agnes Malate from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
No one knows just where or when puppetry was born, but it's traceable back thousands of years and crops up in different versions in cultures all over the world. Sidney Saito has made a lifelong study of the ways inanimate objects can be brought to life. She incorporates puppetry into her teaching at the Waldorf schools, and she and her charges will be performing at tomorrow's Waldorf Fair. And she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
Puppets can be a really valuable tool. You use them in early childhood education, yeah?
That's right.
What is it about them that works so well in that area?
Well, you know, the young children live in movement, mostly, in doing, in kind of acting out what they see all around them. And in puppetry, we're kind of working with that. We're helping them to, we're enhancing their ability to imagine, to telling them a story through the movement of the puppets, and the children just automatically get kind of drawn into that. And it's the way we do it in a Waldorf school is a little different than the Punch and Judy style that most people connect with puppetry. It's the way we do it is much more of a softer, matter-of-fact storytelling, and where gesture is very important, and color, and the actual telling of the story. And we do it, repeat it, so they get it, for a number of days in a row, the same story. And after a while, it becomes internalized, and it's a beautiful way to teach.
You got me thinking about something, that young children sort of think in movement before they think in language. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they live in movement.
Live in movement, yeah.
That is their being, is in movement. And so we, instead of working against that, by having them sit still in chairs most of the day, we have a lot of free play during our morning sessions, and then even that we do circle. There's of course a structure to our day, but we work with movement quite a bit.
Well, one of the things I love about older art forms like puppetry is that they leave a lot of room for the imagination, right? They don't completely take over your mind. There's something for you to contribute.
Absolutely.
That's really kind of how it works, I would think.
Yes. The ancient storytellers were often the wise elders of the community, and they would, of course, storytelling is even more ancient than puppetry, but puppetry began about 3,000 years ago, and most of the cultures in the world had some form or the other of puppetry, where people would move puppets to tell the story, and these stories were told over and over. The people just loved it because they were able then to use their own imaginations to live into this depth of the story.
And you can see how, it sounds like one of those ideas that a lot of people had at roughly the same historical time, because it didn't just start in one country and move to others, right? It started independently in a lot of different places.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, that's what, it's very mysterious, isn't it? And then today we have so many, movies and pictures that are just all finished and given and doesn't leave anything for the individual to create out of themselves.
Yeah,
I
know.
That's why there's, you know, when we do puppetry, say for our Waldorf fair, I look in the room and so many of the adults are just enchanted. There's a hunger for this live storytelling. And, you know, that's what's so much fun about doing these, you know, larger puppet shows for fairs and that kind of thing, is that, you know, you can, every performance is, you know, unique, and it's just, you know, you've got a whole community that's been of people that have created the puppets, they've been working to practice, and then you present the puppet show, and it's just it's exhilarating, and it's a, you know, it's so well received by the community.
You referred earlier to the Punch and Judy, and of course, my immediate thought was, Punch and Judy are always seem to be in conflict. Yeah. You've eliminated that.
Well, you know, in any good story, you have conflict. You
yeah.
have this challenge. There's always some kind of a hero that is often the thought of as the simpleton. You know, the silly one, and
right.
they go through these trials and. You know, there's often some kind of a protagonist that's, you know, working against them, and then, you know, then they overcome, and maybe they're helped by some kind of element, you know, or some being or animal or something has helped them to make that next step.
That really is kind of, you're right, that really is the essence of a story.
Mm.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, and thanks very much for talking with us. Good
you're
luck.
You're so
with
welcome.
Your,
thank you.
You bet. Good luck at your show tomorrow. Cindy Saito and her puppets will perform at this year's Waldorf Fair from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. tomorrow at the Honolulu Waldorf School.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
There may not be many contests this election cycle, local ones that is, marked by high contrast in the ideologies of the candidates, but one place where it clearly shows up is in the OHA race. Chad Blair from Civil Beat has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This is a race that we've touched on in past, but for a lot of people, they hear OHA and they seem to, you know, to check out, that it's not something where, as Neil Milner would say, there are the usual cues to be able to help them to choose and to make, you know, informed choices about it. We're also seeing a whole lot of commercials, it seems, more this time, more visibility. Is this a real change in trying to distinguish these two pairs of candidates?
We'll see. What you have is Bob Lindsay Jr. He's the OHA chair. He's been around for about 10 years. He's facing Mililani Trask, and of course, well-known independence activist, geothermal. She was formerly on OHA. That's a close race. It was in the primary for the Hawaii Island OHA trustee seat. And then the other race is Haunani Apoliona, another longtime veteran, former chair of OHA, facing Kelly'i Akina. And he's also a well-known figure, you know, Grassroots Institute of Hawaii, and even sued to stop that Naiapuni election. So what you have basically is two candidates that are more or less the status quo. They've been on OHA. They think it's doing a good job. And then you have two others who want to come in and shake things up. They want to be watchdogs. They are highly critical of the agency. Now, having said all that, voters just have not seemed to care. And historically, people just don't end up voting for OHA. I mean, our voter turnout's bad enough as it is, but when it comes to OHA races, 40% of the people just leave the ballot blank when it comes to the OHA section.
Which perhaps is one of the reasons that we seem to be seeing a little bit more attention being paid to OHA, the commercials, and some of the, you know, the more highly visible pieces that that we've been receiving these days.
That's exactly right. And what a lot of people don't understand is that OHA, those are statewide races. You know, even although I said Hawaii County, everybody in the state can vote for those candidates. And the only other races that we have are like that, of course, are governor, lieutenant governor, and the U.S. Senate. So this really is our election. But as Neil Milner told us, there's a lot of people that just don't understand what OHA is, what it does. And there's a sense that maybe they shouldn't be involved. It is, after all, an organization dedicated to Native Hawaiian beneficiaries. But remember, it's also a state agency or quasi-agency anyway. And that's why the OHA candidates, all four of them, are trying to drum up support and turn out the vote, because it could make a very decisive difference.
Well, in 11 days, we'll know. Have
Stay
a good
tuned.
Weekend. Stay tuned, exactly. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Bye-bye.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Today being Friday, we always take a look at what our news department is working on for all of us to be listening to in the following week. So come Monday, or at least let's start with maybe later today, with our news director, Bill Dorman, joining me now. We have a very special conversation happening.
Yeah, good morning, Beth Ann. It really is. We've got a special event taking place in our Atherton studio here at Hawaii Public Radio. The event itself isn't until December, but details coming shortly. You'll hear more about it later today. It's a benefit for the homeless. It's going to be a solo show by Jake Shimabukuro. Right here in the Atherton at HPR. And Jake's going to be talking about it this afternoon with Dave Lawrence on the Helping Hands segment of All Things Considered at 5:30 on HPR 1. And the Helping Hand for the Homeless folks from Partners in Care will also be on talking about this. They're going to be beneficiaries of this. Tickets going on sale at the end of next week, but really it's going to be a special show coming in December.
A beautiful pairing for a lot of really great reasons.
Exactly.
Looking forward to hearing what Jake has to say about that later today. And as we look into next week, global warming impacts.
Yeah, you know, locally, very much a localized story about one particular aspect of global warming, and that's sea level rise. It's going to affect all of us, of course, always on the minds of anyone living on an island, but there are certain areas that are more vulnerable, of course. And a couple on this island in particular, a couple places you think of, Waikiki, of course, on a floodplain already, and Kaka'ako. Those two areas of focus for Chris Fletcher over at UH at the Conservation Congress earlier this year. Wayne Yoshioka talked further with him and also with a couple of city and county folks who are looking in more detail about what this means and what this means on the planning circumstances as well. And we'll get some of those thoughts next week.
One of the things that we talked about a little earlier in the show is what's being produced here locally. But one of our exports is our chefs and good food.
Yeah, and Hawaiian food, you know, the Wall Street Journal actually earlier this year said that poke is the new sushi, and as part of their food trends. But it really goes beyond that, and it goes beyond the West Coast, which traditionally is, you know, as you know, in terms of Pacific fusion cuisine, a popular area. This is just straight up local stuff, and it's headed to places like New York City, where Molly Solomon hooked up with a couple of chefs, and one chef in particular who's from here, and talking about how that has grown and why.
Well beyond Las Vegas, and I'm thinking the Bay Area and places where we have been able to easily find Hawaiian cuisine.
Exactly.
All right. Looking forward to all of that for next week.
You bet. One last vote of thanks for everybody who contributed to the pledge drive along that. Seems like a long time ago already, but we appreciate all that support.
Well, people can never hear thank you enough. And believe me, we all appreciate so much everyone's efforts to bring us to a conclusion last Friday. And we'll see where we go from here. It's going to be a good future.
You bet. Mahalo.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director and joins us every Friday with a preview of coming attractions. The biggest challenge parents of young children face is who will look after them. Daycare and preschool costs are huge ticket items for even middle-class parents. That's the finding of a report out this week from NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Couple that with another report also out this week by the National Women's Law Center showing that there is less funding in child care assistance for low-income families today than in 2001, and that hurdle for most families gets even higher. Deborah Zeisman is the executive director of the Hawaii Children's Action Network, and she's here to take a look at what those studies mean to parents in our state. Good morning.
Good morning.
When we had both of these come out in, you know, within literally days of each other, the picture that they both paint is that this is not getting better for parents. In fact, in many cases, it's getting worse. How does that impact us here?
Yeah, that is exactly what these two studies show. We know here and nationally that the cost of child care and quality preschool is an immense stress on families, and families are so stressed out just to make ends meet. And I think that's even more so here in Hawaii. We have a high cost of living. Wages don't always keep up. So we have this kind of perfect storm where the situation is not great for families. It's not definitely not good for children.
What does that mean in terms of how families are making choices? I mean, we hear from even middle class families that if they're looking at doing this or sometimes even, you know, paying family bills, it's a toss up.
Really hard choices. We hear from families all the time, and we always like to hear from more about the actual story and the struggle. That we hear from families who are faced with an impossible choice sometimes, like, do I pay rent or do I pay for quality childcare? And they know, because families know now that quality is important, that those earliest years of life are critical. That's when brain development is happening. That's when kids get ready for school and learn the basics. So you learn how to share. You learn about your letters and your numbers and things like that. So families want the best for their kids. What these studies show is that they really honestly just can't afford it. And so Hawaii is doing well in some areas, and we have a lot of room for growth in some others, and how we really make that work for families. So families can get to work, make sure their child is in a safe, high-quality environment that is also the best place for kids to do all that early development.
Once upon a time, it was thought, well, you know, grandparents will take over some of that role. But really, truly, we have sometimes very young grandparents who are very much in the workforce and will be for the next 15, 20 years. And they also are looking at the fact that we've come through a recession and they're not going to plan to dump out anytime soon and retire early. And they can't do that. So even though we may have multi-generations in Hawaii in a way that other states don't have, and we live together, that we can't rely on our grandparents either.
Right.
So what do families have available to themselves right now? And where are those gaps that we might be able to plug next legislative session?
Right. Well, what we're doing well, according to these studies, compared to other states, is that we do have subsidies available for even middle-income families. So it depends on the number of people in your family and your annual income. But you can actually apply for those subsidies now. You can go to PATCH's website. We can give that to you to put up for your folks and apply. The subsidies are open now. But for example, in Hawaii right now, there's subsidies available if you're a family of four, if you're making up to about $67,000 a year. So that's good. So in some states, these subsidies are only available for really, really low income, like the lowest income families. And Hawaii's really made a big effort to try to make them available for kind of more of our middle income, our working income families as well.
So if you have mom and dad each making about $32,000 or so, and they've got a couple of kids, that would be...
Yep. They probably qualify for some help. Okay, it's a sliding scale kind of piece. So on this other side, though, the bad news from this study, how we compare to other states, is that Hawaii actually has the highest copay that families need to pay. So this is a problem when we are talking about our low-income families. So for a family that's making more like minimum wage, which if you have two people in a household working at minimum wage, they're making about $30,000, $35,000 a year. It's not very much given all of our costs here. And those families are actually only, they're expected to pay almost 20% of their income towards childcare in the way that our formula works in Hawaii right now. Much higher than other states.
So give me a couple of examples.
So, for example, if it's a family of three, two parents and one child, they need childcare, they're making $30,000. So that's around minimum wage. They are still expected to pay $6,000 a year towards childcare. and then the subsidy will pick up the rest. That's a lot, though. If you're making, like, you know, that's rent money, that's food money, that those kinds of things. So what we've seen is in other states, they have invested more money to make sure that families are given enough money to afford that quality care.
So now let's just sort of look forward toward the next legislative session. I mean, we've had conversations about having universal preschool for 4-year-olds and other conversations that have not gone so well. In the light of these studies and what we keep talking about with trying to grow our workforce and making sure that children are flexible and able to move into non-traditional ways of being, because we don't know what it may look like in the next 15, 20 years job-wise in the way that it has in the past. And we also hear from a lot of educators that that teaching those kinds of life skills now become important, and teaching them at an early age. This seems to be, in a way, thwarting where we are with state policy.
Yeah, we really need to sort of pick up that rallying cry. And that's a lot of what my organization is doing. We're trying to grow more superheroes for our keiki, to share those stories and to start putting some more pressure on our lawmakers to say this is what we need to do. Most states across the nation have really been increasing their investment in early learning. They're investing in that workforce development of the future. Hawaii is actually cut our spending in that area in the last couple of years. So the trend is to be, even in Republican states, is actually they're seeing that this gets a great return. This is what we need to do if we want those workers of the future, and to help our working families today. We need to go in this direction. So it's a good year for us to be looking at it. The state has some surplus. I think we need to start pushing and say, how can we make this happen? Families need it. We need to start demanding it.
But you're really talking about trying to make all of the rhetoric that we've heard for a while truly match up with action.
Yep. And we've been talking about it for a long time. People say, yes, 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 this is what we need to do. I think it's up to families to come forward and start applying some more,
pressure.
Demands and pressure to say it's time. We know there's so many other problems in our community that we don't know how to address. Like, we don't know exactly what to do to make housing more affordable.
But
we struggle with solutions on homeless. We know exactly what to do here. We know how to help kids. We know how to help working families, make it a little bit more affordable. And actually, other states have been investing strongly because child care and preschool is a great small business opportunity. So it's small business investment as well within the community. So, but again, we have to kind of put our money where our mouth is.
All right. We'll see if that happens, and we'll be watching.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Deborah Zeisman is the executive director of the Hawaii Children's Action Network. She provides the leadership at HICAN and works with the board of directors and community partners to improve the lives of children.
Aloha, I'm Cisco DeVries from Renewable Funding. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The man known as Sully, Maurice Sullivan, was the founder of Foodland. He convinced his sweetheart's mother, Mama Lau, to open a market, and she did. The first store opened in 1948, and it was an immediate hit. It was so popular, it had to close up midday so the shelves could be restocked. Sully's daughter, Janai Wall, says her dad had a soft heart and liked helping people. Today, at every Foodland location, checkers ask you which school you wish to support. Then a portion of your purchase goes to that school. This is the Shop for Better Education program, and it reflects Sully's generous nature. Because of its success, Foodland added the Give Aloha and Share a Holiday Feast programs. These offer customers a way to give back to their community. We all feel good when we realize we're helping the schools, and you get that bonus shot of dopamine you've heard tell of. Oh, and the kids get a better education, too. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
This morning, we're traveling to the island of Molokai to take a look at the source of hula, an enduring and ancient tradition. Pre-Western oral tradition tells of a woman named La'ila'i who created the dance and kept the secrets of the art within her family in the Ka'ana district of Western Molokai. She died in the 9th century, and her descendants passed down knowledge of the art in secret. 5 generations later, a woman named Laka was born into the clan, and after learning the ways of the dance, she left Molokai against her family's wishes to spread the hula tradition across the Hawaiian Islands. She was deified as the goddess of hula, and the dance has thrived for hundreds of years since. In celebration, a festival is held each May at Papohaku Beach Park, Molokai, Kahula Piko, which translates to Molokai Center of Dance, and it consists of lectures, excursions to cultural sites, food, games, and, of course, hula.
And Danny Akaka Jr. knew that, called us from Kona, and will be receiving an HPR T-shirt. I understand this was a very popular quiz.
I would imagine.
Good to know. Our quizzes are always a fun part of every day, and we rely on a lot of folks to bring us the information. If you have a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now 8:48.
We can only imagine what the seabird population was like in the Hawaiian Islands before the first human contact. Breeding colonies were found throughout the islands, and now these remarkable birds are all too few. The Kauai Endangered Seabirds Recovery Project focuses primarily on 3 endangered seabirds found there: Newell's shearwater, the Hawaiian petrel, and the band-rumped storm petrel. It's been a busy week for the project, and project coordinator Dr. Andre Rain is on the line to bring us up to date. Good morning, Andre.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good. You folks have been getting, you've been rescuing some shearwaters for one thing, right?
We've been taking part in a translocation project this week. We've been up in the mountains of Honanapali Natural Area Reserve collecting chicks, Hawaiian petrel chicks, 20 of them, and taking them from natural burrows and moving them to a new predator-proof enclosure at Nahoku at Kilauea Point National Wildlife Refuge.
What are the predators you're concerned about?
Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of introduced predators on this island. We have, no matter where you go on the island, even in the most remote parts of the mountains, you find cats, feral cats, rats, in particular black rats and Polynesian rats, and pigs and barn owls, which were also introduced to the island. And, our seabirds, they're endemic seabirds, and they're highly endangered, and they're not, they have no way of defending themselves against predators. And so, unfortunately, they're easy prey because they're nesting on the ground, and predators just go into their burrows and pull them out and eat them.
Sure. Well, how do you make a place predator-proof?
Well, with our partners, it's a multi-partner project with Pacific Rim Conservation, American Bird Conservancy, DLNR, Fish and Wildlife, a whole range of different partners. We've got this huge predator-proof fence that's around an area in Kilauea Point National Wildlife Refuge called Nahoku. And basically, it's a giant fence with a lip on it, and it's impermeable to any terrestrial predator down to the size of mice.
Well, that's pretty good, because that could really make a difference, couldn't it?
Well, it really could, yeah. You know, the birds aren't there at the moment, so that's the whole point of the translocation project, is to start this colony here in an area which is going to be easy to manage, and we can keep those introduced predators out, and then hopefully the birds will thrive in there, and when they fledge, they come back and start building the population up in this fenced area.
You've also been rescuing some birds who get into trouble with artificial lights, is that right?
Well, that's another project. That's the Save Our Shearwaters project. And, at this time of year, all of the seabirds, the shearwaters and the petrels, as they're fledging, they come out of the darkness up in the mountains, And as they're flying out to sea for the first time, they get attracted by artificial lights, and they start circling the lights until they get exhausted or they hit a wall, and then they end up on the ground. And once they're on the ground, they're really vulnerable. You know, they either get eaten by predators like cats or dogs, or they get run over by cars. And people, members of the public over, you know, many years here on Kauai have been rescuing these birds and handing them over to save our shearwaters, who then rehabilitate them and release them. And we actually did have a sort of ceremony this week with the Save Our Shearwaters Project, where we released five newel shearwater fledglings and leeches storm petrel with fourth grade and third grade students of the island schools. And that's always a great opportunity for the children to actually see an endangered species, which normally they wouldn't see.
And actually save their lives, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, if they're left on the ground, they almost certainly will die. And so collecting them, you know, members of the public going out and collecting them and then passing them over to the Save Our Shearwaters guys and then having them released out to sea, it gives them a second chance, basically.
And this is, they run into trouble with the lights on their very first attempt to fly out to sea, is that right?
Yeah, well, if you picture where they are, you know, they're now in the most remote parts of the island in these really dark areas up in, mainly in the northwest of the island, and there's these little scattered populations in other parts. But they're in the darkness, and when they fledge for the first time, they're heading out to sea using the moon and stars to guide them. And when it's dark, like if it's a dark night with very little moon, then they get really confused by the lights, and that's why they end up being attracted to them and grounded. It's called fallout.
Understandable. Do the adults, when they're at sea, is that how they guide themselves back to Kauai through using the moon and stars to guide them?
Well, they use a bunch of different methods. I mean, moon and stars is one, and also, you know, visual cues. They come in, they're out fishing, and you know, the petrels can do these amazing journeys. To feed their chicks, they can travel up to 7,500 kilometers away up towards just off Alaska to get food. So they do these giant journeys, which we've discovered by satellite tracking them. And then they come back, and then they wait offshore, I guess using visual cues for the islands. And then when it gets dark, they then fly in under the cover of darkness to their colonies.
Why do they wait for darkness? I'm just curious.
It's probably something to do with, you know, evolving a sort of predator avoidance thing. In the past, that would have been diurnal, like day predators, you know, up in the mountains. And so coming into the darkness, at least they have a chance of avoiding avian predators.
Are they also nocturnal when they're fledging up in these high mountain areas?
Well, we monitor the burrows with cameras, so we get a really good idea of what the chicks get up to. And they, you know, they'll come out once it gets dark, and you'll see them sort of exercising. They do a lot of flapping their wings and wandering around the burrows. And then eventually, you know, after a couple of weeks, they decide they're ready to go. And then normally just maybe an hour or so after dark, they start taking off into the night sky and heading out to sea.
And they can be at sea for how long?
Well, they typically stay away for 3 or 4 years, and then they start coming back, and then they'll court up in the mountains with, you know, over a year or so, and then they have to build their burrows. I mean, a lot of them are digging burrows out of the ground, and they're like little rabbit holes, they look like.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of time and investment before they're ready to start raising a chick. And, you know, they only have one chick a year. And so these are the kind of things that make them really vulnerable, because it takes a long time for them to actually become, you know, viable breeders, and then each year they have put all their energy into raising one chick, and if that chick fails, then that's it for the season.
That really makes keeping them alive quite a challenge.
It does, and you know, it's they're an endemic species. They're only found on the Hawaiian Islands, so they're really special. The newel shearwater, we have 90% of the world population, so they really are our bird, and their population has been doing so badly. You know, we've been looking at data that we've been collecting over the years, and we're estimating a decline of about 80% in the last 20 years. So, yeah, I mean, they're not doing well.
Well, you've got your work cut out for you. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Andre Rain is the project coordinator for the Kauai Endangered Seabird Recovery Project. You can see photos and video of this week's relocation project on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. more and more understanding of the importance of early childhood education. Yeah.
Well, we've been having that now for several years, especially as we know more about how the brain develops. And we talk about this. We talk a good game about it. But the real question is, are we willing to put money and action behind all of that conversation and, in some cases, rhetoric?
You have to catch up with where the research has taken us, yeah?
Well, we try to. You know, I mean, there are pockets of that where that's happening. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, where there are kids who are very young and we hear how difficult it is for families to afford $800 a month, $1,000 a month, $1,200 a month for quality preschool and childcare, or even, you know, part-time at approximately half of that, you know, you've got to wonder if, you know, how much care there is for all children who, you know, you never know where brilliance is going to come from. All kids deserve a chance at being able to reach their potential.
Amen.
That's going to do it for us for this week, and we're going to come back with you next week. We're going to talk with Reverend Jerry Saldus about ministering to foreign longline fishermen.
And Monday we'll bring in a Halloween storyteller to start the day on a spooky note.
You can get to us anytime you like on our talkback line and leave us your comments. We hope you will. Our number is 808-792-8217. Please, though, be sure to leave us your name and the city from which you are calling.
And if you want to hear today's show again, you can hear it on the Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join us on Monday on Halloween when we pick up the conversation.
Ooh.